This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, Murdoch's media empire under fire over a hacking scandal.
It is absolutely disgusting at what has taken place, and I think everyone in this House and indeed this country will be revolted by what they've heard and what they've seen on their television screens.
Also on Inside Europe, a new twist in the Strauss-Kahn sex affair. Is the EU supporting North Korea's dictatorship? And Spaniards take a flutter on new gambling laws. Those stories and more coming up on the programme. The sexual assault case involving former IMF head Dominic Strauss-Kahn seems to take a new turn every day, and France is reeling. Just as the American legal case against Strauss-Kahn seems to be falling apart, his problems in France are growing. This week, a young French woman filed charges of attempted rape against Strauss-Kahn. Eleanor Beardsley has the details from Paris.
Bonsoir et bienvenue à tous. Nouveau rebondissement dans l'affaire Dominic Strauss-Kahn.
The new French case against Dominic Strauss-Kahn is the latest twist in a saga that has gripped France for the last 2 months. It coincides with the potential collapse of the New York case following revelations that undermined the credibility of the hotel maid. Many people who have been shocked by the brutality of the American justice system feel vindicated by the latest developments from New York, says Charles Bremner, who covers France for the London Times.
Once again, France will see itself as the victim of American injustice and American attempts to blacken France in the eyes of the world. From that point of view, Dominic Strauss-Kahn will benefit from a patriotic rallying around him. There will be undoubtedly further conclusions that American justice doesn't work, that the French justice system is much, much better, and so on.
But not everyone is happy about the sudden turn of events in New York. For many women, Strauss-Kahn's arrest seemed to be a turning point, a chance to break the code of silence about sexual harassment and aggression by powerful men. Some now worry that if Strauss-Kahn gets off scot-free, this chance may be lost. Nicole Bacheron is an analyst with the French Foundation for Political Science.
The conversation that had started in France about machism, about the situation and the true relations between men and women, I think it's all taken away by the, oh, you see, it was all a setup, it was all not true.
But the new French legal case against Strauss-Kahn gives many women hope. 32-year-old writer Tristan Bannon says Strauss-Kahn tried to rape her in 2003 when she came to his apartment for an interview. Bannon's lawyer, David Kuby, says her case is solid despite the fact that it goes back 8 years.
D'une violence qui est caractérisée et tout à fait remarquable dans ce type de cas.
Her account of what happened is very serious and full of this man's violence. And if this case doesn't go to trial, that will speak volumes about the French justice system.
Bannon did not bring charges beforehand, she says, because she thought she would be thrown to the wolves if she came up against such a powerful man as Strauss-Kahn. And her mother, a local Socialist Party official, convinced her not to at the time, saying it would ruin her daughter's career. Now her mother, Anne Mansouret, says that was a huge mistake.
My daughter has suffered immensely over this, and she now feels that the only way to rebuild herself is to bring charges against him. Maybe, at last, justice will be done.
Bannon's story was already known in certain circles. In 2007, she recounted what she said happened in Strauss-Kahn's apartment during a TV reality show that took place around a Paris dinner table. He tried to rip off my jeans. We literally fought on the floor, said Bannon. Strauss-Kahn's name was bleeped at the time, but his identity has since been revealed and millions of people have watched the video on the internet. Anne-Elisabeth Moutet, a French journalist who writes for the British newspaper The Sunday Telegraph, believes the Bannon case may be the final nail in Strauss-Kahn's political coffin, but she says the women's movement he started cannot be stopped.
There has been this unanimous reaction from every part of the political spectrum, extreme right to extreme left and everything in between, and all the women are saying the same thing. They're saying men in power in politics but also in business are allowing themselves too many things, and we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. And it's absolutely fascinating that the men don't seem to get it yet, but they will.
Eleanor Beardsley, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
It's been called one of the biggest scandals affecting the British press in living memory, and it threatens global media mogul Rupert Murdoch's reputation. His UK tabloid, The News of the World, hacked into the mobile phone of a murdered schoolgirl while police were still looking for her, a tactic that might have been common practice at the newspaper for years. And after a week of daily scandalous revelations, people are now starting to ask questions over the Prime Minister's judgment when he hired, and later fired, a former News of the World editor as his press secretary. Lash Bhavanga reports.
Millie darling, if you are watching or listening to this, Mum, Dad, Gemma, Granny and all the family want you to know that we all love you and we really miss you. And we can't wait to have you back home with us.
Sally Dowler appealing to her missing daughter, Millie, to get in touch after she disappeared in 2002. Her family hoped she was alive because her mobile voicemail had been cleared to make space for more messages. They didn't know it had been done by an investigator hired by the UK's largest Sunday tabloid, The News of the World. Millie Dowler was found murdered 6 months later.
I cannot believe what has happened in the Millie Dowler case. Frankly, to take the messages off, then to actually take them away to get more messages about a poor old girl who'd been murdered, it's the bottom of the list. I don't think you can go any worse than this.
That's John Prescott, Labour politician and former Deputy Prime Minister. He's one of thousands of politicians and celebrities who police say may have had their mobile phones hacked by the News of the World over many years. The tabloid's owners, News International, is the UK arm of media mogul Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation. Until recently, it's maintained newspaper bosses knew nothing about the illegal hacking, blaming a few rogue reporters. Now News International says it's doing what it can to help a major police investigation into all allegations of phone hacking at the News of the World.
Let me be very clear. Yes, we do need to have an inquiry, possibly inquiries, into what has happened.
On Wednesday, Prime Minister David Cameron agreed to a public inquiry into how News of the World journalists have been able to carry on illegally phone hacking for years and to find out how much News International bosses knew. This could see News Corporation CEO Rupert Murdoch himself being called to testify. The scandal now involves the phones of other murder victims' families and families of people killed in the 7/7 terrorist attack in London.
Let us be clear, we are no longer talking here about politicians and celebrities. We're talking about murder victims, potentially terrorist victims, having their phones hacked into. It is absolutely disgusting at what has taken place, and I think everyone in this House, and indeed this country, will be revolted by what they've heard and what they've seen on their television screens.
But David Cameron himself is facing some tough questions in all this. He's personally close to top people at News International, and he hired Andy Coulson as his press secretary after he'd resign as editor of News of the World in the wake of the hacking scandal involving mainly celebrities. That's not good judgment from the country's leader. Opposition Labour leader Ed Miliband told Parliament on Wednesday.
He made a catastrophic error of judgment by bringing Andy Coulson into the heart of his Downing Street machine.
Andy Coulson was forced to resign as the Prime Minister's press secretary in January when the scandal began to escalate. This week, it also emerged News International had provided police with evidence showing Coulson gave the go-ahead for his reporters to pay police officers for information while he was editor at the News of the World.
With its infinitely flexible seven seats, the new Ford Grand C-Max is designed and built around...
The political ramifications of this scandal are yet to be fully played out, but the backlash against the newspaper at the centre of it all is already in full swing. Ford Motor Cars was the first of many major companies to suspend their advertising at News of the World. That means a considerable loss in revenue for the newspaper, which is now bracing itself for what its readers might do. Many believe a considerable chunk of the readership will boycott the tabloid on Sunday, dealing it a double, if not fatal, blow in terms of revenue. Lars Bevanger, Deutsche Welle Radio, Manchester.
The European Union is preparing to send wheat and other food supplies to North Korea, which is facing a severe food crisis. The move to free up 10 million euros in aid to one of the world's most repressive and secretive regimes has raised eyebrows. But the European Commission says the country's food supply has been devastated by drought and severe flooding, and that it's essential aid reaches those most at risk. I asked our Brussels correspondent Vanessa Mock about the timing of the aid.
It's reacting because of the exceptional circumstances that North Korea is facing, particularly when it comes to crops. So North Korea has been buffeted by droughts. Then there's been periods of severe flooding, particularly in the north of the country, and then a foot and mouth disease and other types of factors that have really, really put huge pressure on the already very small production of food in the country. And the other thing that has never really happened before is that North Korea actually came knocking on the EU's door and directly asked for help. The big problem, though, of course, is that even though you have these short-term factors, droughts, flooding, the problem is structural and political. Any analyst, I think, who watches the country will tell you that the method of farming, the way that the regime runs the economy, is completely inadequate. The EU will tell you that the regime is effectively starving its own people. It says that the way it's withholding food supplies is outrageous. And yet, I think after a lot of soul-searching, the suffering has been deemed so great that the EU has decided to tip its reaction in favour of humanitarian help.
Now, the EU says it will only target a fraction of those in need. And indeed, 10 million euros doesn't sound a lot when you consider the need there.
No, in fact, it's a tiny amount. We're talking about food supplies for just a period of a quarter of a year, 3 months, for 650,000 people. Now, see that in the context of the fact that an estimated 6 million North Koreans are thought to be severely malnourished. Well, that's nothing at all. But this really is a trial test. The EU says it wants to target those who are really most at risk. So we're talking about infants, babies, lactating mothers, and the elderly. And it says that by keeping the numbers low, it's really the only way that it can control the distribution of all this aid. And of course, that's a basic tenet of humanitarian aid is, you know, the fact that you can keep a good oversight of whether the food is really reaching the people. Commissioner Georgieva, who's the EU's humanitarian aid official, says this is really uppermost in their mind, making sure that the programme is executed in the right way.
We have 3 months until the next harvest. This is the most critical time. And I can say that we can credibly execute a program for 650,000 people so we can be certain that our help is actually reaching the little kid whose life and future depends on it.
3 years ago, the EU suspended aid because it said its supplies were not reaching the people. So what's changed?
Well, what's changed is that for the first time, a team of EU experts was allowed into the country for, I think, close to 2 weeks. They were allowed to visit things like hospitals, children's nurseries, be in direct contact with the World Food Programme. And they've received assurances from the authorities in Pyongyang themselves that this is going to happen. But perhaps most of all is that the EU has made very clear that if there's any tampering at all, the aid will be suspended. And the big concern, which has happened in previous years, is that the food goes into feeding the country's vast army. Commissioner Georgieva says this will not happen again.
There may be safeguards, but why is the EU resuming aid when the US and Japan are not?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think the first answer to that is lack of trust after years of broken promises by Pyongyang. also deep political tensions between the United States, Japan, South Korea, with what is effectively still one of the world's most repressive regimes. And I think the thinking, particularly in places like Tokyo, is if you give aid to the people on the ground, you are effectively propping up the regime, which is something that nobody wants to do. And there are also deep-seated fears that this aid will be used by Pyongyang to send out a political message, basically saying, well, look, we're talking to all our global partners. We're basically no longer a persona non grata. And that's why even major think tanks like the International Crisis Group really have very deep misgivings about what the EU is doing right now. Here's Alain de Lettreau, who's the director of the Brussels office of the Crisis Group.
I have no doubt that the regime will try to portray that as a new victory, international victory, or a victory of its diplomacy, a new show-off that it is fully integrated and recognized on the international scene.
So as you can hear, a lot of concerns. We'll have to wait now the next couple of months just to see whether this aid is reaching the people and whether the needs become so dramatic that the EU really has to start pressuring countries like the United States to perhaps resume more direct dialogue with North Korea. But for the moment, still a very, very difficult call politically, I think.
And that was our correspondent Vanessa Mock in Brussels. And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Germany and Saudi Arabia are reported to be in the midst of negotiations for a multi-billion euro arms deal. Opposition lawmakers say it contravenes the country's export guidelines for military hardware. The deal is allegedly for a total of 200 Leopard 2 tanks to be bought by Riyadh as part of an effort to boost the country's security forces. The German government has so far declined to confirm the deal, citing national security concerns. Uwe Hessler reports from Berlin.
Reuters cites a Saudi security source speaking on condition of anonymity who said that 44 out of a total of 200 tanks had already been purchased by the Saudi government. German Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle is eager to keep details of the deal under wraps, claiming he's bound to secrecy by national security laws. I'm not going to talk publicly about any details of the negotiations, he says, but you can rest assured that deliberations are being conducted in a responsible manner in the National Security Council. The Council consists of 9 high-ranking members of the government, and it's the only panel with the power to pass decisions about German arms exports. But it's forced to abide by Germany's sweeping arms export guidelines, which prohibit the sale of arms in crisis regions or to governments that violate human rights. When taking this into account, says Green Party leader Jürgen Trittin, Saudi Arabia should never be permitted to acquire German tanks. Saudi Arabia was just recently involved in quelling the pro-democracy movement in Bahrain, he says. Attempts to provide such a regime with such high-tech weapons would mean crossing a line which all previous German governments had stayed well clear of. At the moment, it's unclear why the conservative-led government would appear willing to overturn existing German arms export policy for the benefit of this tank sale. Some experts suspect the German government may want to help build up Saudi arsenals in an effort to turn the country into a regional counterweight to Iran. Uwe Hessler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
In Spain, people like to gamble, whether it's on the lottery, on soccer games, or more recently, online. But for a long time, the laws regulating these activities have been vague and unclear. Now, the country finally has a new set of regulations that experts say will transform the gambling scene in Spain. Guy Hetchko reports from Madrid.
Whether it's buying lottery tickets, a trip to the casino, or putting money on the soccer game, Spaniards like to place a bet.
There's a lot of people gambling now in Spain
because the Spanish people are gamblers.
Marcos Manchado is one of those who likes an occasional flutter. He gambles mostly online.
Once or twice a week, and not a lot of money, small accounts. Play poker.
Gambling is worth 30 billion euros per year in this country. But those in the sector have often complained that the rules regulating it are chaotic and confusing. Now, new legislation has overhauled Spanish gambling for the first time since the return to democracy in the late 70s. The new law was approved in May, although it is still being unrolled to take full effect in January 2012. Diego Ramos is head of the commercial law department at legal firm DLA Piper in Madrid. He says Spain's gambling legislation has now been unified and clarified.
The new law covers everything. International gambling, online gambling, offline gambling, traditional gambling, everything. Overall, this is going to be positive.
This is one of Spain's most traditional sounds. Children announcing the winning numbers in the Christmas lottery, or El Gordo, which is 200 years old. But in a matter of weeks, Spain has now gone from having a notoriously chaotic set of gambling regulations to having one of the strictest laws in Europe. Ramos says although the new tight regulations modernise the sector, they're also something of a throwback to the old days.
The role of the state has always remained very, very intense. It was only very recently that private companies, you know, were allowed to start betting and gambling like in other European countries, you know.
The new law ensures all gambling operators have full Spanish licenses. It also seeks to protect minors and gambling addicts and introduces hefty fines for companies that flout the rules. But perhaps the biggest change contained in the new law is that it finally acknowledges online gambling, which is worth around 1 billion euros per year. Until now, internet gambling operators could operate in Spain without needing a license and without paying tax. All they needed was a web page. Now, all operators, offline and online, have to register and pay tax. This legal change is music to the ears of companies that specialise in traditional offline gambling. Rafael Catalá is the Secretary General of Codere, the only Spanish gambling firm to be listed on the Madrid Stock Exchange. Codere has online gambling operations in other countries, but not in Spain, because until now, the law did not acknowledge them.
During the last 5-6 years, here in Spain, has been a lot of companies making business, making online gaming without a license and without paying taxes, making business and so making publicity, etc. For us, it's very important that we make a situation equilibrated for all the players.
But despite the mostly warm welcome Spain's new gambling law has received, things aren't all rosy for the sector. There's a chance online operators might be frightened away by the austerity of the new regulations. Also, revenue has nosedived over the last couple of years, with turnover from slot machines down 15% on a year ago, and bingo turnover down 25%. One reason for this is the economic crisis. Another is Spain's new law against smoking in public places, meaning people spend less time in gambling-friendly venues, such as bars and bingo halls. Perhaps Spain's gambling industry, which has only been around in its current form for 3 decades, is in decline. But don't bet on it. Guy Hedgeco, Deutsche Welle Radio, Madrid.
If you have a comment or query about the programme, do get in touch with us. Our email address is europe@dw-world.de. Looking forward to hearing from you. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. Over the next half hour, an historic ruling for the victims of Srebrenica.
My father handed my sister over to my mother, and he just kissed her goodbye. And my mother and I and my brother, we didn't even have time to kiss him. And I was trying to look back to see him one last time, because I knew that's going to be the last time that I saw my father alive.
Also on the programme, tributes to a blue blood described as a great European. The Vatican embraces modern art and will meet the man travelling 5,000 kilometres across Europe on muscle power. Those stories and more coming up. It's 16 years this month since the massacre at Srebrenica. This Bosnian town was under the protection of the UN, but was overrun by Bosnian Serb forces, resulting in the deaths of around 8,000 Muslim men and boys. On Monday, the commander of those soldiers, General Ratko Mladic, was ejected from the courtroom at the UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague after refusing to comply with the chamber's rules. But on Tuesday, an historic moment took place for the survivors and relatives of Srebrenica's victims. An appeals court in the Netherlands ruled that the Dutch state was responsible for the deaths of three Muslim men during the massacre. The UN battalion guarding Srebrenica was made up of Dutch soldiers. Cynthia Taylor has more on why the court's ruling is significant.
Dutchbert had hen daarom niet van de compound mogen sturen.
There was no gavel or even any emotional reaction. Hasan Juhanovic had been waiting for this moment for over 16 years, but he was silent and motionless when the verdict was announced that the Dutch troops in Srebrenica had no right to expel his family from the UN compound they had sought refuge in July 1995.
I didn't expect it. No, really, I didn't expect it. I need some time to think about it, you know? I don't know what to say, really, because I prepared myself for the negative outcome. So I didn't prepare myself for the positive outcome.
Hassan was a UN translator working for the Dutch peacekeeping battalion in the Srebrenica enclave. When Bosnian Serb troops led by Ratko Mladic entered the area, he took his parents and younger brother inside the UN compound in the hope of a safe evacuation. They were joined by some other 6,000 refugees. But 2 days later, the Dutch troops ordered everyone to leave. Hassan was allowed to stay because he worked there, but his family had to go. However, at the last moment, just before they stepped out of the gates, Dutch Major Robert Franken told Hassan his father could stay too.
And then my father shows like this in the direction of my brother. He says, "What about my younger son, you know, and my wife?" And Franken says to me, translate, he said, "Well, it's his choice." And so my father smiled at Franken, he shook hands with him, and he walked out of the compound. So my father chose to die with his younger son instead of choosing to live with his elder son.
And you can understand your father's decision?
Of course I can.
Hassan's father was exhumed from a mass grave 11 years later. They found the remains of his mother in 2009 and those of his brother Muhammad last year. He was 19 years old. The sport shoes Hassan had given him 2 months earlier looked brand new, and the laces were still tied. On the site of the Srebrenica Memorial, the remains of more than 600 people are being buried this year. Among them is Rizzo Mustavic. He was an electrician for the Dutch battalion. He considered the troops to be his friends and often invited them to his home. But in that July, he too was ordered to leave the compound with his family. His daughter Alma was 15 at the time.
And at that moment, my father handed my sister over to my mother. And he just kissed her goodbye. And my mother and I and my brother, we didn't even have the time to kiss him. And I know I was trying to look back to see him one last time because I knew that's going to be the last time that I saw my father alive.
Both Alma's family and Hassan have been battling for this verdict for 9 years. And according to their lawyer, Lisbeth Zegveld, it is a turning point in international justice.
The court has now ruled that state responsibility does exist, although there was a peacekeeping operation and command and control has been transferred to the United Nations, which is not in denial by anyone. And still, you can be held accountable for wrongdoing during that peacekeeping operation. And the state has always warned, almost threatened during the proceedings, if that happens, if this is going to be established, there's a chance we won't contribute any new troops. And that will also be the reflex of many other states.
Survivors and relatives of the Srebrenica victims have long been accusing the Dutch troops of negligence and of voluntarily handing over the refugees to Bosnian Serb troops. And although the Netherlands has always said it did its best to protect the Bosnian Muslim population, it was always clear to Alma and Hassan that the Dutch troops knew the danger their relatives faced outside the base.
How many more bodies should have been outside of the base? How many more executions should have happened in front of the base in the presence of the Dutch battalion soldiers for them to understand that, yes, when we send these people out of the base, they will probably be killed? That's my question to the Dutch, really. I mean, is it not enough to see 15, 20, 25 dead people and see executions on the spot? Do you need 50, 200? I mean, what's the number?
The court's ruling may well encourage more relatives to take legal action against the Dutch state. And this is not the end of the road for Hassan or the Mustafic family either. They're also suing three top Dutch military officials, including the major who didn't allow Hassan's brother to stay in the compound. The suspected killers of Hassan's mother are to stand trial too, and they're considering legal action against Ratko Mladic. It's 16 years later, but for many families, the fight for justice has only just begun.
All right.
Cynthia Taylor, Deutsche Welle Radio, The Hague.
Well, next week, another important legal decision is expected. A court in the UK will hear an appeal by WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange against extradition to Sweden to face rape charges. Assange's defence team and international commentators have found fault with Swedish legislation and even alleged the victim's claims might be politically motivated. But since the allegations emerged, the debate in Sweden has been more sympathetic to the women. In fact, the case has prompted Swedes to talk about rape in a new way. Joanna Impey went to Stockholm to meet Swedish women behind the public debate.
A long line of pushchairs, complete with babies and matching pale blue covers, bring traffic to a near standstill in central Stockholm. The mums and a few dads are marching for women's rights. Talk about it. That's the message from the mums at the march, and that's also the name of a website set up after Swedish journalist Johanna Koljonen started to tweet about her own experiences of not knowing where to draw the line in sexual situations. Now, several other journalists have come forward with their stories, all prompted by the Assange case. In her studio apartment in Stockholm, Sonja Schwarzenberger is checking the latest comments on the Talk About It website. She's a radio and TV presenter, and until recently she edited the Swedish feminist magazine, Bang.
I just suddenly felt not just that it was the right thing to do, to tell my story, but I could. It just created this room, this fantastic room, where you realize I am not alone with this experience, and it's not such a taboo to talk about anymore.
2 days later, Sonja wrote an article in a national newspaper talking about a very personal experience. Her boyfriend had initiated sex with her when she was asleep. Sonja wrote about the difficulties of setting boundaries in sexual relationships.
For me, my part, it was to explain like how guilt can really grab you, although you don't understand why, and there was no one to point fingers at you, but you did it yourself. And why it can be hard. You can be the most hardcore feminist and still don't tell, don't say, and feel guilty about it.
In no time, hundreds of people were blogging about diverse sexual experiences, their comments revealing a high level of uncertainty about what's right and what's acceptable. Lottie Hellström is preparing a rape examination kit for her next patient. She's a doctor at Sweden's only rape crisis clinic. Lottie's followed the Talk About It debate and believes that such uncertainty is common.
many women, I believe most women actually can tell something about, that they have been overwhelmed, convinced, or not taken seriously and respected in this way. So there's been a discussion, is this rape or not? And in most cases you come to the conclusion it is. It is rape to have non-consensual sex in any way, in any circumstance.
Sweden has the highest number of reported rape cases per head of population in Europe. Lottie says there are no more rape cases in the country than anywhere else, but that women are more ready to come forward when they feel they've been violated. Anna Hjelden knows the Stockholm Rape Crisis Clinic only too well. She was abused by her partner for many years. Now she's speaking out about her experiences, and she doesn't want to be treated like a stereotypical victim, downtrodden and intimidated. She stresses she's a woman with a full life and a successful career as a jazz singer.
It actually started by me getting fed up of people asking me, why didn't you go? Why didn't you leave? Why did you help him? Because the last thing that happened to me was domestic violence for the children's father. So I wrote a song. And I actually went to our government and I sang it.
How can I defend myself? How can I mend myself? If we all keep hiding the truth.
After leaving her partner, Anna teamed up with the Red Cross and formed an organisation to use survivors' experiences to train those who work with abuse victims. Like journalist Sonia, she thinks the solution is partly to talk more openly and frankly about sexual violence.
We're living in a world where sex is used as a power instead of a gift. I think once these words spread out, anyone can feel related to what I'm speaking to and say, yeah, let's do it. It's just the way of looking at the problem, to look at us as experts instead of victims.
Joanna Rimpi, Deutsche Welle Radio, Stockholm.
Was he lovely in his sleep? Was my darkness caused by closing eyes? Maybe he's not a dreamer. Maybe he didn't ever want to treat me well.
One of Europe's eldest statesmen died this week. Otto von Habsburg, who was 98, was the son of the last Austro-Hungarian emperor. He was born as the Habsburg Empire was collapsing, and after resigning himself to the fact that he'd never sit on the throne, threw his energies into reuniting a Europe torn apart by war and communism. Kerry Skyring looks back at the man described as a great European.
The summer of 1989, and Otto von Habsburg is on the border between Austria and Hungary. The Iron Curtain still exists, but it's about to be torn open. This was the so-called Pan-European Picnic, a peace demonstration organised by the son of the last emperor of these lands. Soon, the East German holidaymakers gathered here would begin streaming over the border, while armed guards turned their backs. Otto von Habsburg had a thing about borders.
Wenn ich eine Grenze überschreite, wo früher eine Barriere war,
when I cross over a border where there was once a barrier, where once the people couldn't cross, and that was not so long ago, it's gone. It's so wonderful, such a joyous feeling when one crosses over.
After giving up hope of regaining any imperial role, he threw himself into supporting the countries of Eastern Europe, which were under communist rule.
I think the main force driving Otto von Habsburg towards European integration was his deeply rooted anti-communism.
Austrian historian Oliver Ratkolb, he says Habsburg used his family's historical links to countries behind the Iron Curtain to push them towards reunification with Western Europe.
But in the end, I think the main issue is how to preserve Western Europe, and especially also from his point of view, the Catholic Christian tradition of Western Europe within the Cold War. This, I think, is the overruling factor. Yeah? But certainly he always tried to bring back his experiences and also his political socialization in the Central European sphere into this issue. But I think the main force is the Cold War and anti-communism.
The tributes to Otto Habsburg have been glowing. A European giant, said the president of the European Parliament, Jerzy Buzek. All Europe cries, said another parliamentarian. Such praise reflects Habsburg's status as a member of the European Parliament for 2 decades, representing the conservative Christian Social Union of Bavaria. Austrian leaders have also praised him, but it's been more restrained, reflecting a difficult relationship with the country he was born to rule. Stefan Bayer worked for Otto von Habsburg and has written a biography. He praises Habsburg's opposition to the Nazis' annexation of Austria.
Interestingly, Hitler actually thought the resistance would come mainly from this direction. That's why the Nazis called this operation Operation Otto. So here was a royal successor prepared to put his life on the line so that Austria would resist.
But many Austrians linked Otto Habsburg's opposition to the Anschluss to his ambitions to rule Austria, and with some justification. In 1937, Otto wrote, "God willing, the hour of reunion between the Duke, meaning himself, and the people, will soon arrive." Oliver Ratkolb says this suspicion of his motives continued almost until his death.
Habsburg always was seen in the Austrian political arena as someone who tried, at least until the 1950s, 60s, to play some form of political role in Austrian political life, and was not seen as a European parliamentarian and politician until recently, except monarchistic circles.
One of the criticisms of Otto von Habsburg is that he was late to discover democracy and late to drop his claim to the Austrian throne. He finally did it in 1961 and eventually was allowed to visit the country of his birth in 1966, the first time since his family was expelled in 1918 when he was about 6 years old. There's no doubt that for much of his early life he wanted to come back to Austria as emperor. Equally, there's no doubt that for much of his later life, he was a passionate European parliamentarian. In a recent interview, he explained it like this.
As an MP, I was very happy. When one meets a really stupid person, an idiot, I can describe him as an idiot. If I'd been a monarch, I would have to describe him as His Excellence.
The funeral service for the former Empress Zita, Otto von Habsburg's mother, in Vienna's St. Stephen's Cathedral in 1989. A similar grand send-off is planned for her son, who will then be interned with over 140 other Habsburgs in the imperial crypt. Austrians may have rejected him for most of his life, but Otto von Habsburg is now welcome home. Kerry Skyring, Deutsche Welle Radio, Vienna.
And I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe.
Italians set off from England on a journey to Istanbul. Not the easy way by plane, but by rowing boat. The voyage will take Giacomo De Stefano 6 months to complete. He'll pass through 15 countries and cover around 5,200 kilometres. He's called this project Man on the River. Well, Giacomo's just arrived here in Germany, and I rang him up on board to find out why he's making this journey.
Well, first of all, is the protection and care for water. Water is life, is our main element after air, probably. The second is protection of local economies, trying to promote sustainable and local economies, trying to eat local food. And the third goal is to bring a sustainable way of traveling, slow and very respectful of the environment, of the water, of the animals, of the fauna, of the flora we meet.
You've already journeyed through France. Was it all plain sailing or were there unforeseen problems?
Mostly it was very, very, very pleasant, wonderful. Some problem with the people taking care of the tunnels, the locks. Imagine that we passed till now 275 locks, including the 20 on the Thames River. So there are a lot. So sometimes they didn't want us to pass with a rowing boat.
How many kilometers do you average each day?
Average in the French Canal was around 20, between 20 and 30 kilometers a day.
And it must be quite strenuous when you have to row against the current.
Oh, yes. On the Main River, it will be quite hard. There are many locks, so the current is not so hard. But, you know, sailing and rowing on a river is a very funny and challenging way of rowing and sailing because you cannot fight against the current. She is too strong for us, for human. So you have to use your intelligence and try to go where she's a little bit weaker. You go next to the river banks and you try to go in the inner part of the curve.
And what do you do about eating?
Our aim was to find, for instance, local farmers and to barter, to have some food. But in France, for instance, we cross many parts completely, I would say, desert, no people, a lot of forest. And it was very difficult to find a farmer. So we go and buy, we try to buy local food in the local shops. And even this is not so easy because we are traveling a very slow budget because we want to show and demonstrate that it is possible to travel across Europe.
Now, I believe you're only using the sun and the stars to navigate by. You're not using any satellite navigation equipment. Is it possible to take a wrong turn on some of these rivers and canals and get lost?
Well, sometimes it is. Yeah, we have to be very careful sometimes because we have to talk to people. And it's very bizarre, the fact that most of the people, they really don't know the river. They know 10 kilometers. Beyond the 10 kilometers, they cannot tell you anything. So we have to use our instinct. Sometimes we use maps, charts, and till now, it was okay. We never made big mistakes. We never lose more than half an hour.
Giacomo, finally, what's the first thing you're going to do when you reach Istanbul? Have a shower, maybe?
Well, have a shower and probably hug the people that I will see in the Koch Museum, which is on the Golden Horn, because if I can make it, inshallah, for us will be such a great thing. And I think a lot of people could really have a very good income because it will be a new way and a very old way of traveling. Very good for the environment, the local economies, and for the animals living on the water.
And that was Giacomo De Stefano, an Italian who's rowing across Europe. Modern art is getting a boost from the Vatican. This week, Pope Benedict XVI opened an exhibit at the Holy See containing the works of 60 contemporary artists from around the world. Painters, sculptors, even jewellers were invited to reflect on universal themes in choosing their entries. Jean Di Marino has more.
A rendition of the Lord's Prayer, the score for which was composed by Arvo Pärt, opened the Contemporary Art Exhibition at the Vatican this week. The piece is the Estonian composer's own submission to the event. He's one of 60 contemporary artists invited to contribute works on the theme of the splendour of the truth and the beauty of charity. The exhibition is one of the celebrations marking a significant event for Pope Benedict XVI, the 60th anniversary of his ordination as a priest. The pontiff used the occasion to issue an appeal to all artists.
Fate risplendere la verità nelle vostre opere.
Let the truth shine forth in your works and make sure that their beauty inspires in the eyes and hearts of those who admire them the desire and need to make all existence beautiful and true.
On show are paintings and sculptures, photographs, poetry, jewellery and film. The exhibition is the latest step in the Vatican's bid to reconcile with the world of contemporary art. Richard Rouse from the Pontifical Council for Culture helped organise the spectacle.
We always say that the church wants to be human. The church wants to be where the people are. And if artists today are speaking a strange and colourful and language with a new grammar, it's important the church participates in that dialogue.
The Vatican was once the world's most important patron. A pope commissioned Michelangelo to paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel and Raphael to paint his portrait. Christian themes such as the Last Supper inspired artists like Leonardo da Vinci and Tintoretto. But for the last few hundred years, art and the Roman Catholic Church have grown apart. The secular world, governments, foundations, collectors and museums have taken over as commissioners. Modern artists have often used religious symbols to provoke rather than to inspire.
I thank you very much for embracing.
American painter Max Cole is exhibiting a work she'd produced for an earlier showing. Called Salt Flat, it features a pattern of horizontal lines articulated with tiny upright strokes. On meeting the pontiff, the leader in minimalist painting thanked him for embracing art and artists.
And it's refreshing that those doors are now opened again. And I think that Pope Benedict is extraordinary in his welcome hand. It's much appreciated.
Spanish-born artist Pedro Cano submitted a watercolour, a metre by a metre and a half, called Verso Roma, or Towards Rome. It shows a modern pilgrim, a man with a cane, looking at one of the ancient gates of the capital.
What would have been the history of art without the help the Church gave artists? There would have been no Piero della Francesca, there would have been no Caravaggio, no Michelangelo, Leonardo or Velázquez.
But just how ready is the Church to let artists express themselves as they wish? Oliviero Rinaldi's bronze sculpture of Pope John Paul II outside Rome's main train station was criticised by the Vatican. It said the work didn't conform to the original design and looked nothing like the man.
Many people expected a conventional proposal, as there are in many churches, a statue made in a very realistic manner. I took another route completely. I chose a more theological portrait, an allegory, that was strongly symbolic.
Still, Rinaldi was invited to enter this week's exhibition. He submitted an oil painting of a large white figure with arms outstretched, part of a series called Santo or Saint. He says Benedict XVI was pleased.
It went well. I believe that he really liked what I came to communicate.
The contemporary art exhibit runs until early September, and its officials say the Vatican is considering commissioning more works on universal themes for a Venice Biennale of the future, possibly in 2013. Jean Di Marino, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Hope you enjoyed today's program. If so, join us at the same time next week. Till then, that's all from me, Helen Sini, my colleague Neil King, and sound engineer Uwe Ross. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle Radio in Bonn.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.